This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of The New Yorker and WNYC Studios.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Masha Gessen is one of our keenest observers of Russia and Russian politics. She grew up in the Soviet Union in its latter days, emigrated with her family to the U.S., and then returned to Russia as a reporter. So she's got a unique perspective on the U.S.-Russia relationship. And all through the Mueller investigation, she warned people not to expect some kind of magical revelation or smoking gun of collusion between Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump. In 2018, she sat down at the New Yorker Festival with a guest she knows pretty well, her younger brother, Keith Gessen.
So this is a completely self-service panel. We're going to talk about ourselves, interview each other, introduce ourselves. So this is my brother, Keith.
Keith Gessen is a founder of the magazine N Plus One, and he teaches journalism at Columbia University. He's written two novels, most recently, A Terrible Country, which came out last year.
Okay, this is my sister, Masha. She is the person who, in whose shadow I dwell, but in fact, it is more like she is the sunlight. Yes, in whose rays I grow. Oh, okay.
So I'm very happy to welcome you to our conversation. Yes, I will ask the first few questions, if that's okay.
That is fine.
So in late 2013, because of various unpleasant developments in Russia, you moved to Moscow. I mean, you moved from Moscow to New York after being away for 20 years. You've always worked kind of in both countries. But when you went back to Russia, you became a Russian language journalist.
Right.
Working for Russian publications. You were publishing books and articles in the U.S., but your kind of day job was as a Russian language journalist. And now you've moved back to the States and become primarily an English language journalist.
Right.
So what has that been like?
Well, it's actually has been lovely because there's a line in your most recent book that is absolutely brilliant. You describe a character who, in some ways, bears a certain resemblance to me. You're observing the narrator is observing this character walking around Moscow, and says nobody liked him here, and that put him at ease. I think the experience of not being liked by anybody, it might be sort of character building, but it's really lovely to just not have that on a daily basis. Like, I hardly get any death threats. It's lovely.
Do you want to talk about our parents?
Right now? Right here? Sure.
When I think about our immigration, our parents were in their mid to late 30s. And I grew up thinking, well, you know, basically their lives are over, right? And so the only possible reason they could have emigrated was for us. And I kind of felt like you had mixed feelings about it. about our immigration, you know, and you kind of left home. So I was like, well, it was just me. they did it for me, so I better do good.
You did well.
Thank you. Yes. So from your perspective, is that, what do you think?
I think that for them it was very important not to see us go through the experience of applying to university and experiencing what they did, which was just really explicit discrimination against Jews. It's one thing to know about injustice and unfairness, and it's another thing to come face to face with it and have it be completely sort of unabashed. I think for both of them it was a formative thing, and so they didn't want to see us go through that. But mostly I think they thought they were doing it for themselves. And you know, they were like in their mid-30s. They had their entire lives ahead of them. But they really, I mean, I've thought about it a lot. I've thought about what kind of courage it would have taken to just step into the abyss. I mean, they knew nothing about this, right? They read a few letters from people who had emigrated. And so they stepped into the abyss. But our dad, our mom died a long time ago, but our dad always responds by saying, we thought of it as a great adventure.
Do you want to talk about politics a little bit?
Sure.
Yeah? Okay. What? You didn't like hearing about our parents? I found that very therapeutic, so thank you. Has being here and writing about Russia changed your perspective in terms of what Americans need to know and need to hear?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, I think that the perception of Russia has really gone through some very strange permutations in the last, I mean, I've been here for just under 5 years. And it's been a very strange 5 years for, I think, how Russia is perceived in this country.
You found yourself in the somewhat curious position of having been a person who was writing about Putin and kind of warning about Putin for a long time. And now you're in the position of saying, hey, you know, relax. sometimes I go on Twitter, I see people calling you a paid propagandist for Putin.
I know. No,
I was amazing.
I've been called a Russia Putin shill, or yeah, paid Putin propagandist. There's an online community of anti-Trump Russian immigrants who, yeah, they had a long thread going about how I was, whether I was intimidated or paid into what they see as supporting Putin, yeah.
And they say that because you have been skeptical all along, first of about the evidence, but then, you know, about the significance of the Russian interference in the election.
Right. In a way, you know, I was one of the originators of that narrative, right, when I wrote a book about Putin. And now I find myself in the very strange position of saying, come on, you know, he's not that kind of monster. He's a different kind of monster, right? But not the kind of monster who's masterminded the takeover of the entire Western world. He doesn't have the mind for that kind of masterminding, among other things.
Do you feel partly responsible for this narrative?
What an interesting question. yeah, a bit, but and the problem with writing, with journalism, or any kind of writing, it is so impossible to predict how much influence what you write will have and what kind of influence it will have and what sorts of anxieties and imaginaries it will tap into. I can acknowledge sort of contributing to that narrative, but I don't think that I can take too much responsibility for it. And I also don't want to overestimate the number of people who buy, you know, thick nonfiction books and actually read them. But you wrote this fascinating article for the New York Times Magazine earlier this year on so-called Russia hands. And you posit a kind of dichotomy in that article that some people basically think that everything that has gone wrong in the Russian-American relationship over the last 25 years, which is basically everything and consistently, regardless of who was in charge, was attributable to Russia and its intransigence and its own trajectory. And then there are those who think that it was bad American policy and American failure to move past the Cold War narrative, right? And I think that that's actually that almost perfectly describes the stories that I have been writing versus the stories that you've been writing.
You mean I am more likely to blame the U.S.?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's my strong position.
Do you ever worry that that actually overestimates American agency and it's a kind of backhanded imperialist position?
That's an interesting question. yes and no. I think the article, kind of traced American policy toward Russia in the post-Cold War era through the sort of people who were inside the government, in the State Department, the National Security Council, who were kind of running Russia policy. And the article began because I had watched Obama seem to really want to de-escalate tensions with Russia and really de-emphasize Russia in general, which struck me as objectively correct, right? Russia is a troubled country that is declining, right? Unlike its neighbor to the east, China, which is not declining. And that was the kind of Obama argument, right, for shifting our focus to the east. And yet, under Obama, you get the Ukraine crisis and eventually the hacking of the Democrats. And I was like, well, how, why did that happen? Here you had a president who had kind of made his preferences pretty clear. Is there a deep state? Right, which, and when I started working on it, this had not been popularized by the right, or at least I had not come across it. And I mean, the partial answer is yes. Presidents come and go, policymakers, the people who they appoint come and go, but there is this kind of small core that moves between the State Department and the National Security Council. You know, and one of the kind of really surprising things to me about them was just how strong their views were.
Right.
And you talk to them and they're quite convincing. For example, some of these people were in the kind of center of debates over NATO and whether it should be expanded. And their position was, we have this historic opportunity to push the sort of zone of security, as they called it, but other times they would call it the free world, right, or the West, closer to the borders of Russia, right? Because eventually Russia will come back and threaten those neighbors, and you could say, well, they've been proved correct.
I was just going to ask.
Yes, or you can say this was a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? And I don't know if the U.S. had had a very different policy, whether we would have had a totally different result. I don't know.
Let's shift gears.
Okay.
So you wrote this book, and I know that the process of writing that book was quite interesting and lengthy, right? You set out to write something fairly different. Can you talk about that?
Sure. So it's basically a kind of a story about a guy who goes, who is actually a loser, and goes to Moscow to take care of his grandmother, at the request of his swashbuckling entrepreneurial older brother, who's not based on Masha.
No.
He has this fantasy that she's going to tell him stories about socialism, and this will then, he'll write these stories down, and then it'll help him get an academic job. And then he shows up there, and she can't remember who he is, much less a detailed narrative about Stalinist Russia. Yeah, and then I finished this draft, and I kind of read it, and it was horrible. And I cut all that stuff out.
Why was it horrible?
It was just boring. It was just really, really boring. What I realized, a few years into the process was that actually the grandmother needs to be a kind of central figure, not just as a kind of domestic background, but her life needs to make the central argument about what happened after the Soviet Union fell apart. And as you know, I changed some details, but it did strike me that our own grandmother's life, she hated the Soviet Union, and she was delighted when the Soviet Union fell apart. And then she lost her life savings. The town in which she lived, you know, fell apart. The research institute where her husband worked fell apart. She lost her sense of self in the world, I think. I mean, it struck me that that story made a pretty good case for the post-Soviet transition being not so great. So once I figured that out and kind of made the grandmother a more central character, the book became a lot better.
It is definitely no longer boring. Yeah, I read it in like one night instead of sleeping. And there were all sorts of reasons for me not to want to read it at all, or never mind in one night. No, but it's a really great book. Are you thinking of writing a nonfiction book?
I thought we weren't going to. Yes, I am definitely.
Wait,
yes,
I thought you were. We don't have to talk about it.
We don't have
we
to talk about
it. Our parents.
Yes, I am. Yes, I'm working on it.
What's the book?
I'm working on that.
Okay, all right.
You wrote a piece called Rules for Autocracy.
I did.
And it was written, you know, directly after the election, right? So, you know, very much in the heat of the moment. But I wanted to revisit that and see how much of that you still think, you know, holds, and where you were wrong and right, right? So, you know, the first rule for surviving autocracy is believe the autocrat. When he says he's going to do something nasty, chances are he will. So one thing that you said that might lead to, you know, when they say lock her up, they're going to lock her up. It hasn't happened yet.
Hasn't happened.
What do you think that means?
It means that journalists should never make predictions, is what it means. And I think that, you know, the way that that piece happened was that I'd, like probably many people in this room, I'd been to a disastrous election night party and kind of crawled away without saying goodbye. And when I was on my way home, biking from Queens, I started getting phone calls and emails from people saying, what do we do now? Like, well, how should I know? You know, I had to flee my country. Obviously, I don't have the answers. But as it's a long bike ride, so as I was biking, I was thinking that there are actually things that that I learned from living in a country that was what democracy it had was dismantling itself, right? And was creating an autocracy. And I think that there are things that I learned about how you survive mentally and spiritually in that. But, you know, I think that the rule, believe the autocrat, is, I completely stand by it. And what I was trying to get across was something that I had learned actually in the process of reporting my Putin book. Was that when I went back and listened to his interviews and his press conferences, and fortunately the man has such a small presence that it was possible to listen to everything he had said and study it in some detail. So when I did that, I realized that it was all out there. He said exactly what he was planning to do. But people both in Russia and in this country had ideas about what he represented that had nothing to do with what he was putting forward.
Another rule is the institutions will not save you. Do you think they've held up a little bit better than you had expected?
I don't, actually. I don't think they've held up better than I expected. And I think the damage he's been able to do has been profound and has perhaps even been more profound than I thought, like, in the first 2 years. I mean, I think the Kavanaugh confirmation has been great, amazing illustration of that, right? I mean, now here's the great institution of the Supreme Court that just stands, I think, exposed, you know, with the curtain pulled back in a way that that maybe sort of emotionally we could have anticipated a couple of years ago, but I don't think we could have imagined. I mean, it is shocking.
What do you say to the argument that, you know, the Supreme Court's a great example? I mean, the real kind of norm breaking there was the refusal to seat Merrick Garland or even to discuss
right.
Merrick Garland by Mitch McConnell, right? So that predates Trump.
And I don't, you know, Trump didn't come out from outer space. He did not actually come from Russia. He came from here. And we're out of time.
All right. That's great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
The New Yorker's Masha Gessen talking with her brother, Keith Gessen. And between the two of them, they've written more than a dozen books and more than 1,000 articles, many of which have appeared in the pages of The New Yorker. Keith's most recent book is a novel set in Russia called A Terrible Country. And Masha's most recent book also deals with Russia, but it's nonfiction. It's called The Future is History. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour, and in a moment, we'll join critic Emily Nussbaum in conversation with the veteran actress Christine Baranski.
Who goes to Hollywood at 42 and was an overnight star in that way that you become a star because of television?
That's just ahead.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Emily Nussbaum watches more TV than any 16 people I know. She's The New Yorker's television critic, and she won the Pulitzer Prize for her work in 2016. So when Emily Nussbaum gets excited about interviewing an actor, you know there's got to be a good reason.
I'm delighted to welcome Christine Baranski, who is not only a quadruple and probably more threat performer and a radical fashion inspiration, but my personal guide through today's political hellscape. In her current guise as Diane Lockhart on the wonderful CBS drama The Good Fight, and on Ms. Baranski's been microdosing her way through the Trump apocalypse, becoming appropriately unhinged in a series of the most amazing necklaces on the planet.
Baranski was already a stage veteran, performing Shakespeare and winning Tony Awards on Broadway, when she suddenly shot to fame on television with the show Sybil. She played Marianne, a martini-swilling best friend character who got most of the best zingers in the show. She danced with Robin Williams in The Birdcage and crooned with Meryl Streep in Mamma Mia, and she's been in top-rated sitcoms from Frasier to The Big Bang Theory.
Christine is a 15-time Emmy Award nominee. She's won 2 Tonys for The Real Thing and Rumors. And she has a house in Connecticut where she gets to go skinny dipping at night. So basically, she's living the life. Welcome, Christine Baranski.
Thank you.
We were talking backstage and we immediately went into a political rabbit hole. So rather than start with anything political, I'm going to start with a clip from Mamma Mia.
Now you're so cute, I like your style, and I know what you mean when you give me a flash of that smile. Oh, but you're only a child. Well, I can dance with you, honey, if you think it's funny. Dance your mouth and blow out your eyes, and I can shout and make it clear.
Maybe we should all just sit around singing ABBA songs.
You know?
This is the first Mamma Mia, of course. The second one just appeared this summer, which I thought was a public service because I mean, you go from being, God, this is really kind of silly, and oh, God. And then I realized the world really needs a couple of hours to still believe life is joyous and people get along and there's sensuality and a belief in love. And there's just a goofy innocence about the movie that's really, as I said, it performs a function now.
So I'm going to show another clip, and we're going to jump right to the good fight. And this trip is called Trump Derangement Syndrome.
This is deranged. This is the Trump Derangement Syndrome. You're just as bad as you're accusing him of being.
No, I'm just done with being the adult in the room. I am done with being the compliant and the sensible one, standing stoically by while the other side picks my pockets. While the other side gerrymanders Democrats out of existence, a 3-million-person majority, and we lost the presidency. A Congress that keeps a Supreme Court justice from being seated because he was chosen by a Democratic president.
That's not what happened.
That is exactly what happened, Julius.
Okay, then. Take to the streets. Man the barricades. Because if that's what you really think, you've given up on the law. You've gone well beyond any...
Actually, you don't know. I have a Smith & Wesson 64 in my desk, and I'm this close to taking to the streets. There's an uncanny synchronicity to this character. As I watch this, my eyes are welling up in tears as I watch this. It's so of the moment. It's just brilliantly written, but it really puts intelligent, liberal-minded people who believe in the liberal democratic tradition and society and in their country, puts them in a workplace and lets them bump into each other and mix ideas and make intellectual arguments that are complex and not strident, but that this woman, this Diane character, for having fought the good fight all her life, being a woman who probably followed Hillary into, you know, through Wellesley and championed her and had to, you know, knock on the glass ceiling many times and finds herself at this present moment living in a country where we're backsliding in terms of women's rights. It's a marvelous role to play, and it's a marvelous show to be on because the writers just kind of take us into the belly of the beast and let us live in that world. And this past season really had, especially Diane, trying to, with her great rationality, you know, for 7 years you saw her on The Good Fight being the grown-up in the room or the rational one or the voice of reason, and to see that character not be able to cope, to see that woman say, I can't process this, I'm going crazy, I can't turn the TV off, but I feel like I have to bear witness to this. It's very, very interesting to watch. And I said to Michelle King, our head writer, last week, I said, you know, we're going to have to just go right into this again, given what's happening. And she said, yep, we're, you know, that's where we're going to be in season three, is following the women.
And The Good Fight was supposed to be a show about Hillary being president. Instead, it was a show about Trump being president, which obviously transformed the show.
We shot that pilot the days before and the days after the election. And then, of course, we had to rewrite the pilot because the presumption was Diane was going to retire because there are no more glass ceilings to break, and she gets the house in the south of France, and then she loses her money. But there was a speech at the very beginning where she's talking about, you know, there are no more glass ceilings to break. And it was written as a line thinking that Hillary Clinton was going to be the president. And so that line was taken out, and we had to rewrite the episode. So now it seems like Diane got the house in the south of France because she didn't want to live in the United States.
Every element of it just changes context.
This seems like a good lead into a clip from Sybil. So let's go to a clip from Sybil.
Champagne for everyone. at that table.
Champagne at lunch? Oh, we haven't had that since yesterday.
Sybil, I have fabulous news. My prodigal son is returning.
Justin is coming home for Thanksgiving. That's wonderful. I knew he'd come back.
It's been 3 years, Sybil, without a word. You remember the night he left? I'd just come back from that Save Our Furs benefit. He told me he hated my entire pampered, materialistic existence. Then he asked for $2,000 and left for Peru.
Maybe being away 3 years changed his mind, or maybe the money ran out.
Sybil, I don't want to celebrate another 40th birthday without him. I want to prove to him that I'm not something he has to run away from. And I'm going to start by showing him the best old-fashioned Thanksgiving we've ever had. Well, except for that one in Aruba with Ivana Trump and Richard Simmons.
Hey, I've got an idea. Why don't you bring Justin to my house? Everyone's in town. So I'm going to make a good old-fashioned Memphis Thanksgiving. I'm going to use all four Southern food groups. Sugar, salt, grease, and alcohol.
It sounds tempting, but I can't.
Oh, come on. The whole family's going to be there, and you're part of my family. Did I mention there'll be alcohol?
I'd love to, darling, but I want Justin all to myself this weekend. I'm even going to cook all his favorite health foods. Oh, one question. Is it still correct to call it brown rice, or is it rice of color?
You know, I watched all these old Sybils, and I have to say, it is a very surreal show to watch because it is a real time capsule of the period. Like, even like the Ivana.
Look at the hair.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
What was that like the first year that you were making Sybil? Because there really was this complete. And also, actually, I was wondering, because you came largely as a stage actress, and television was in a very different stage.
Oh, God, yeah. And there was still that conflict of, you know, if you did television, you were giving up the theater. I mean, now it's everybody's doing everything, and actually everybody wants a job on television because there's so much great writing on television. But at that time, I was seriously conflicted. And I was in my early 40s by then, and I had just, except for some films, I was really a theater actress and defined myself that way. Plus, they weren't shooting shows in New York. For the most part, all especially sitcoms, were shot in L.A., and I had two children, and I didn't want to raise them in L.A. So I just kept turning down pilots. And then they approached me about this, and the character was meant to be a kind of Ab Fab Joanna Lumley type. Mm-hmm. And I was doing the math on how much it would cost to educate my two daughters, and it seemed like the theater was not going to, you know, provide that kind of income. So I began to seriously consider it. But it was a really tortured decision, and my manager, who's here today, she'll tell you. I mean, she really had to talk me into it, and the night before I left, I almost called her in the middle of the night to say, I just don't think I can do it. It's too big a step, and I decided not to move the children to LA, but that we would try my commuting back and forth. So, but it was a huge psychological jump for me to go to Hollywood and to do a sitcom. That said, if ever there was a sitcom that was right for me to do at that moment in time, it was that role. And in that show, Chuck Lorre wrote the pilot, and I did accept it on the basis of the pilot, which just, I thought, this character, there's, you know, she's just got those great, you know, whip-smart one-liners. And the one line that sold me on the whole project was when Sybil's just out of the blue says, you know something, you know what's amazing, Marianne? And my response is, they make vodka from wheat. Just, there's something there about that writing that I think I can work with this. And I told Chuck that, and he later confessed, it's not a Chuck Lorre line, it's his writing partner, Lee Aronson, who's a recovered alcoholic. But anyway, yeah, that character, within 13 episodes, I won an Emmy for that. And mm-hmm. to that I attribute, you know, I give it over to Chuck Lorre and the writing of that character. No one had seen that woman on American television. They'd seen Ab Fab. But she was the first out of the gate Sex and the City came later. But the woman with the martini, who was sort of a badass in her outfits and her attitude, that was the first of its kind. And boy, it changed my career. Those were really hard years. I hated living alone in a hotel. I missed my kids so desperately. But it's why I'm here. It's why I had a relationship all those years with CBS. It was a turning point in my career. And who goes to Hollywood at 42 and, you know, is an overnight, you know, kind of star in that way that you become a star because of television? I mean, I was a well-known theater actress, but not a celebrity, not a star. No.
I wanted to, you talk about your long relationship with CBS. I'm wondering how people are responding to what's going on with Les Moonves.
I think Leslie Moonves was loved and highly respected. It's infinitely sad what's happened. I will miss him. When Les took over the network, I was beginning my second season of Sybil, so I was at a photo shoot. And this man came up to me and he said, "Christine, you don't remember me, but I used to hand you your paycheck at Playwrights Horizons back in the early 80s. And Les was in the production office at Playwrights Horizons and handed me a paycheck for about, $125 a week. So we go back that far, and I said to him, "Well, you're paying me a lot more now, aren't you?" Sybil. Long, happy relationship working with CBS. It is shocking, but that's where the culture is, and it's a clarifying moment in our culture, and I think it's going to be messy before it gets better, but I will miss Les. Yeah.
I was wondering, with you and your daughters, who are a lawyer, when you've had conversations about what's going on, do you find there to be a generational difference between you and your perspectives on some of these issues, or is that not so true?
Only slightly. Well, yes, I did get into one conversation with my daughter about men's behavior and how I was raised. I was raised, you know, in a Catholic background, in all-girls Catholic high school, and it was just instilled in us as young women that men were that way, that they couldn't control themselves after a certain point. I mean, I literally was told, if you let a man touch you anywhere below the neck, he might turn into an uncontrollable wild animal, and it's your responsibility if you get pregnant. You have to control the narrative. And I told this to my daughter, and she said, no is no at any point, in the evening, if no matter what's going on. I said, that's interesting. That's just not the way I was raised. I would never go to a man's room late at night. I just assume that he might very well behave badly. And there's that difference, but it's how we were raised. But I'm proud of my daughters. I think they're very savvy about their feminism, and they're not strident, but they're clear-headed about it and pragmatic. And one of my daughters did get a law degree, and she was really agonizing whether or not to go to law school. It's such a huge commitment. And I said, look, you can rail against the world, but if you want to change things, you've got to know how the system works. And becoming a lawyer, as Diane did, you figure out how the system works, however flawed it is, and then you figure out how to change it. But, you know, blogging and railing against the machine with a lot of hyperbole, a lot of screaming isn't going to get us there. And I think at this moment in time for women, it's the most important time to be clear-headed, rational, as well as passionate and angry. Channel the anger in an intelligent, clear, forward-moving way.
It's so hard to talk about this stuff because I find myself feeling all those emotional feelings and wanting to escape from it all. And you went to Oxford to study, right?
I did. My daughter, my other daughter, Lily, got a graduate degree at Wolfson College at Oxford in anthropology. And when I took her there to, help her move in, I was just utterly captivated by Oxford. One of my deep regrets in my life is that I did not have a real college education and academic experience in that way. I went straight to Juilliard, which, although it was a prestigious acting school, was trade school. You know, I learned the craft of acting, and I'm happy I did, and that was my great passion. But I've always longed to go back to school and use more of my brain and my intellect. So there's a summer course called the Oxford Experience, and next year I'm signed up for the Duke of Wellington, one week, and then the Meaning of Life the following week. So I'll do 2 weeks next year.
The Meaning of Life just as a subject matter?
Why not?
Not like the Monty Python film.
No, no, just the Meaning of Life in 1 week at Oxford. You should have me back next year. I'll have all the answers.
You know a whole situation.
So this is it.
Thank you so much to everybody for coming. And thank you to Christine Baranski.
Christine Baranski speaking with The New Yorker's Emily Nussbaum in 2018. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour with more to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Kurt Vile was a founder of the rock band The War on Drugs, but he left the band shortly after its debut to make records all of his own. His albums with his backing band, The Violators, include Childish Prodigy, Smoke Ring for My Halo, and last year's record, Bottle It In. He's sometimes been characterized as slacker rock, but he takes songwriting extremely seriously.
Loved you all a long, long while. Looked down into a deep, dark well. Called all your names, they echoed down for miles and miles. And all that other mystical well, never you mind.
Kurt Vile, that's his real name, by the way, has also appeared on the comedy show Portlandia and HBO's animated series Animals. He played a singing squirrel. In the fall of 2018, he joined Amanda Petrusich on stage at the New Yorker Festival.
You were a clue on Jeopardy last year. This is one of my favorite Kurt Vile facts.
Well, it's college Jeopardy.
Well, it's kind of a weird clue. The clue was the Violators assist this pretty pimpin' rocker in his foul work.
Yeah. He's the Riddler. Like, how nobody could even understand. Even if they knew the answer, they'd be like, wait, what?
It was a complicated
clue. Going on there.
Nonetheless, I would imagine being a Jeopardy clue has to be some sort of milestone. That's got to be super weird. Who was the first person who told you?
You don't know her.
You grew up one of 10 children. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about what it was like growing up in your family?
Yeah, it was pretty annoying. No, it was pretty cool, but it was like... no space, you know, for, like, the boys' room had 5 boys in it. Because of that, I can, like, sleep through anything, and I can just tune in and out whenever, you know, whenever people are talking, I can like be listening or not.
And now you yourself have got two young daughters. How would you characterize yourself as a parent?
Father of the year. No, it's awesome having kids, and they're still pretty young, and they're really into music and reading, and yeah, they're total brats in the best way.
Do they like your songs?
Yeah, like the one, my oldest, Awilda, she like listens intensely to words, and the youngest, Delphine, she'll go straight to a piano or guitar and just start playing, so.
When did you start writing songs?
Well, I started playing a string instrument, like a banjo, when I was 14. I probably started writing songs right around then, but I made my first like cassette when I was 17. I would put out a tape or a CDR, but I would call it my album as if it was like really, really, you know. But they didn't really become real albums until I was 28. But
Did you make your own cover art
totally.
CDRs?
Yeah.
I used to do that for mixed CDs. So the banjo was your first instrument, and that's kind of what you learned to write on?
Yeah, my dad wished I was like a bluegrass musician. So like a year before, maybe when I was 13, he hung it over my head later. He's like, we were going to get you a guitar for Christmas, but you were really bad this year. So the next year, he's like, I could get you this banjo. And I wasn't sure, but then he worked for SEPTA, like drove trains, and a conductor, he basically was going to buy the banjo off this conductor, and the conductor played it over the phone, you know, the telephone, not the cellophone. And it sounded really cool through the telephone, so I was like, all right. But I kind of just treated it like a guitar. I just strum it, but yeah.
Who are some of your favorite songwriters?
So many, let's see. You know, there's like the classics, of course, like Bob Dylan and Neil Young, and then there's like Townes Van Zandt.
Well, you had the chance to open for Neil Young last
year. John Prine. Yes, I opened for Neil Young recently. It was pretty funny. I was terrified. There was like 80,000 people. And,
wow.
And I just kind of like what I'm doing now, but with the guitar in my hand. It's like, I came out real cocky. I was like joke singing like some kind of Stevie Nicks thing. And then I was like, I got the crystal vision. And then I was like...
Did you get a chance to meet Neil?
I met him multiple times, but only for a split second. And the best time was a couple times before I got backstage. It was the first time I saw him with Promise of the Real. And these kids, Willie Nelson's sons and other kids, they back him up really good. And I weaseled my way backstage with my wife, Suzanne, and she egged me on to like say hi. And so I did, and I was like, oh, Neil, I've seen you like 10 times, and it's always amazing, but this was the best by far, Down by the River, which was like 30 minutes long. I was like, it's like you were underground in outer space at the same time. It was unbelievable. And he was like, he was smiling all nice, and then when I said that, he was like, oh, yeah, we can go in outer space whenever we want. and then I got a picture with him, and that was cool. Every time I see him, it's where he just played a show. And even if we have friends in common, it doesn't matter, because you're just like, I'm still a fanboy. But this last time, his bandmates, I'm hugging all of them. They, like, in between, they're all passing around a jazz cigarette. I'm usually scared to do this. I used to love it as a kid, and then I can't. It's harder to deal with it, but I'm trying. But but anyway, I grabbed it from the drummer, and me and my wife tried it out for the first time ever. No, just kidding. But then, anyway, they came off the stage, and we're feeling really weird, and everybody's sort of just around him. And then he's just about to get away, as he usually does. And then I was like, well, I should just give him this Sadie CD, which is my friend's that we have. He knows who the Sadies are, and usually it just makes more sense than being like, I'm Kurt Vile again. So I was like, I'll just give him this Sadie CD. So I literally jumped down and I was like, hey, Neil, you get the new Sadies? And then everybody was like, hey! And they all, and like his manager, Elliot Roberts, he's a legend, but he's old now. And he was like about to check me like a hockey player. But then I got it to him though.
there is I think a dryness and a kind of absurdist humor to a lot of your lyrics that I just find so sort of intoxicating and beguiling. Some of it recalls, I mean, you mentioned Dylan, you mentioned John Prine, I think two lyricists and writers who do this really well. A line like, "Girl, you gave me rabies," and I don't mean maybe.
Yeah, well.
I mean, how do you sort of think about lyrics in relation to rhythm or in relation to melody, and kind of where does the lyric writing fall within your songwriting process?
Well, and I don't mean maybe, I plagiarized from like Bo Diddley or other people, you know, they always say that, or other blues people, they say, and I don't mean maybe. And then,
they don't rhyme it with rabies.
And then the girl you gave me rabies, that's a true story. So.
How did you get rabies, Kurt?
From a girl.
I'm not buying this.
Well.
Is this like rabies the new mom?
No, I'm lying.
The kissing
I'm
disease?
Lying.
I figured. Why don't we hear some music?
Okay. All right.
Morning, didn't recognize the man in the mirror. Then I laughed and I said, "Oh, silly me, that's just me." Then I proceeded to brush some stranger's teeth, but they were my teeth, and I was weightless, quivering like some leaf coming the window of a restroom. I couldn't tell you what the hell it was supposed to mean, cause it was a Monday, not Tuesday, not Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. Then Saturday came around and I said, "Who that stupid clown blocking my bathroom sink?" But he was sporting all my clothes, the guy say pretty pimping. Yeah.
The musician Kurt Vile. He spoke with Amanda Petrusich, who writes about music and culture and much more for The New Yorker. I'm David Remnick, and that's it for this week. I hope to see you next time.
Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. Our team includes Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Caroline Lester, Louis Mitchell, Sarah Nix, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Emily Mann and Jessica Henderson. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.